Welcome to the PoliticalBetting.com Polling Matters Show. My name is Kieran Pedley. We're reaching the final stages of the US presidential race, and the stakes could not be higher. This week, we've seen those Trump tapes and also the second US presidential debate. But is Hillary Clinton the shoo-in that most people now think she is? I'm going to be discussing with my panel today, and let's get on with it. So let's introduce my guests. We've got Mark Gutterson from Portobello Communications, who's also an expert on US politics and a veteran of several US and UK campaigns. Welcome, Mark. We have Chris Gilson, managing editor of the LSE USA blog. Welcome, Chris. And we also have Denise Barron, producer and co-host of The Ballpark, but also a veteran of many US campaigns. Welcome, Denise.
Thank you.
So, guys, let's crack on. There's certainly lots to discuss. I think the first thing is to get people's reactions to the second presidential debate at the weekend. It feels like a long time ago now. I'm just going to read out some of the polling numbers off the back of that, because there were several sort of post-debate polls. But they did seem to suggest that Hillary Clinton came out on top. Morning Consult had Clinton 42, Trump 28. YouGov, Clinton 47, Trump 42. And NBC, Clinton 44, Trump 34. So, you know, different numbers, but ultimately a Clinton victory. Denise, I'll come to you first. What was your sort of reaction to the debate?
Sure. So, I mean, I think that the first half hour was very difficult to watch, not only as an American, but just as someone who has been in the room with candidates when they're prepping for these debates. It's a very stressful situation. And if these debates in this election cycle have highlighted anything, it's the not only the importance of preparation, but the role that preparation has played in the way that they interact with each other. You can almost see the wheels turning in Hillary Clinton's head of how to keep composed, how to maintain a certain neutral expression, how to not react too heavily to everything that he says. And if there's anything that she recognizes that she has to do in these, it's not let those little reactions get in the way of what she's saying. Not let those little minor tics, a certain way of phrasing something, laughing something off, not let that predispose voters to not being able to listen to her reaction fully, if that makes sense.
I mean, Chris, it certainly seemed like she was trying to sort of rise above the fray, as Denise alludes to, and talk to voters. Difficult job of Donald Trump, of course.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one point I find really interesting about these debates is actually, if you look at compared to previous elections, the win hasn't, on Hillary Clinton's side, as people are saying, hasn't been that dramatic. But it's been pointed out by the media as to having been sort of a wall-to-wall destruction of the candidate. And I think a lot of it's based on how the media actually reacts. If you look at these polls, I wonder how much of this is people reacting to what things like what CNN have said and what commentators have said have been the winners. So going back to the first debate, when I watched that, I felt that, you know, Clinton didn't actually perform amazingly well. She was actually quite wooden, similar for the second as well, compared to how dynamic she could have been. And I think actually her performance hasn't been hugely stellar. It's just that Trump is quite bombastic, and I think it's interesting comparing to previous years.
Mm. I mean, Mark, that's true about polling, isn't it? Actually, you know, the poll that comes out that says that Hillary Clinton won convincingly ultimately leads the media narrative that she won and feeds into the subsequent polls, doesn't it? So I suppose this podcast is rightly called Polling Matters in that instance.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Though you have to remember, untold millions of Americans do watch these debates. And I think it's really interesting. The second debate was kind of a perfect storm for Republicans. Donald Trump did not do well. He did not do well enough to stem the flow of voters, of moderate centrist voters away from his candidacy. But at the same time, he didn't do so catastrophically to increase the sort of cacophony of establishment Republicans disowning him, setting sort of RNC, Republican National Committee, procedures in place to replace him as a candidate. On Saturday, you started having people saying, oh, the RNC is contacting lawyers about how to replace Trump. By Monday, that had all gone. All this chatter had gone. Perhaps they were told, quite rightly, it was impossible.
Plus 74% of GOP voters actually said, no, we want to keep Trump.
Well, indeed. But I don't think the RNC, you know, I think the RNC is more concerned about winning the election than about what 74% of its voters think. But I thought that was very interesting. So in some ways, okay, not a disaster for Donald Trump on paper, but perhaps a disaster for the Republicans.
And we've actually had some senior GOP people actually walk this back to Trump as well. I can't remember the name, but I think it was one senator or something like that has actually come back and said, after disowning him, they've come back and now are supporting him again.
Really?
Yes. God. So what we might actually see is a moving back of people saying, well, okay, you know, everyone's got such short memories, such a short attention span in this cycle. And I wonder if next week the polls will have tightened a bit. People, I don't think they'll forget the tapes, but I think they'll forget the
tapes. I mean, it speaks to expectations as well, too. I mean, where before these debates, people would talk about what Donald Trump needs to do and what Hillary needs to do in order to constitute a win or even just a draw. And basically, Donald Trump needed to not trip over himself, fall down, or knock over the podium and start yelling, or basically take out his phone and start tweeting. I mean, that's what he needed to not do. And what she needed to not do was be too smiley or be too stern or be too wonky or be too emotional. Or, you know, I mean, the tight line that she had to walk is almost unhuman, while what he had to do was basically just not set his own hair on fire.
That's not really fair, is it? I mean, it's one of the bugbear of mine. Is
I believe it is his own hair.
Sure.
Well, that's what they say. I mean, because this idea of expectation management, as though you can be a terrible candidate, but as long as you're not as terrible as you're supposed to be, then that somehow is a win. It feels strange. Let's look at some of the polls, though. There was this NBC Wall Street Journal poll that came out that got a lot of attention because of the size of Clinton's lead. And those people watching the show will see that poll on the left-hand side and a recent but not the latest 538 projection on the right, which has Hillary Clinton with an 83% chance of winning the presidency. So this NBC poll had Clinton on 45, Trump on 36, Johnson 8, Stein 2. So a 9-point lead. But there was something, Mark, that I thought was interesting in looking at this, knowing the UK polls. One of the things that UK polls does is tries to maybe not wait directly to past vote recall, but at least take it into account when they're factoring in the voting intention numbers. American pollsters don't seem to do that. And the past vote recall for 2012, so that's people being polled now, being asked, how did you vote last time, was Obama 46, Romney 32. Now, there is this theory that people remember voting for the winner because, of course, I did. There's a risk there, isn't there, that actually this is undersampling Trump voters?
I don't think so. My instinct is that the Trump coalition is a new, is in large part, okay, has a lot of former Republicans in it, but it's large part new voters, people who haven't voted in previous cycles, people who, when they were younger, perhaps even registered Democrats who voted for Reagan but have sat on their hands, has on their hands since then. My instinct is this looks about right. There are a lot of, I think, particularly educated Christian conservatives out there who intend to sit on their hands at this election and haven't expressed a preference either way. What's very interesting about the Trump campaign is how narrow their socioeconomic and demographic targeting is in this election, such that huge sections of the traditional Republican coalition they're completely ignoring.
No, I would disagree a little bit, though, in terms of the Trump campaign pulling in new voters. They talk about that, and they talk about bringing in non-traditional or perhaps people who haven't been registered before, but the numbers don't show that, particularly in swing states. So places like Ohio, Colorado, Pennsylvania, actually the left-leaning organizations have been doing more to register more people and register more new voters. And so I would disagree on that side of it, even though that's what the Trump campaign has purported to be their field game.
So you're saying the Trump campaign is not being entirely truthful?
I'm saying they're trumping up their own, their new appeal to this brand new different type of voter.
That is a shocking accusation. Looking at the Electoral College map, so I mean 538 have theirs, but obviously everyone can have their own sort of interpretation of what's going on. A state that I always keep an eye out for is Florida, because I just feel like, yes, there is literally a path for Donald Trump if he doesn't win Florida, but it doesn't feel very easy to reach. I mean, Denise, what states are you watching in terms of the Electoral College?
Yeah, so I'm a little bit biased towards Colorado. That's where I was working and living for 4 years before moving over here. And it's one of those states that is very interesting demographically, because it essentially is a microcosm of the U.S., in terms of racial makeup. So it's very telling in terms of how things are shifting in the U.S., but then also how different groups are leaning. And then another one we were talking about before the show that, again, I am biased towards because I lived there, but Indiana. And that's a state that is, despite everything that has happened, is still leaning red for Trump. And that's despite the fact
that Mike Pence or...
Yeah, well, maybe, perhaps, but Mike Pence has not been hugely popular. And it's also despite the fact that Evan Bayh is also at the top of the ticket. He's running for Senate this year. And he, you know, is a former governor, former senator. He's a very highly popular person, is actually favored to win in that race. Now, that's a state that also went blue for the first time in about 40 years in 2008. So these are voters who are willing to vote for a Democrat for the very, very top of the ticket. But there's something very unique about what's going on in Indiana that I think Trump has tapped into. And, I mean, generally, that doesn't shock me.
I mean, given how, I think it's fair to say, divisive both candidates seem to be, with different people, of course, I'm interested in some numbers that same NBC poll produced about what Americans are voting for or against. And what do we mean by this? So one of the things that this NBC Wall Street Journal poll has done is, not just now, but in the previous election, it's asked people, are they voting for the candidate, e.g. for Clinton, or are they voting against Trump? And the numbers are quite interesting. So if you compare Hillary Clinton to Obama voters in 2012, we see that it's pretty evenly split for Clinton. 49% say they're of Clinton voters now say they're voting for Hillary. 46% say they're voting against Trump. On the other hand, Obama voters in 2012, 72% said that they were voting for Obama, so enthusiasm there, I guess, and 22% against Romney. Compared to the Republicans, it's quite similar, actually, for both Trump voters and Romney voters. For Trump, 39, against Clinton, 53. So Trump voters, believe it or not, are more likely to be saying they're voting against Hillary than for Trump. And it was very, very similar numbers for Romney in 2012. For Romney, 35, against Obama, 58. I just want to get the panel's reaction to some of that. I mean, Chris, I'll come to you. I haven't come to you in a while. What do some of these numbers tell you?
Well, I think it's interesting if you look at the Obama numbers in 2012. I mean, Obama was seen then as being a transformational figure. You know, you just have 8 years of the George W. Bush administration. He was new and he was exciting, the first black president, possibly. Clinton is old news. It's hard to be excited about her, I think, for Democratic voters, even if they have decided to vote for her. Mm-hmm. And there's also a bias against women that's come across in lots of political science studies as well. Voters tend not to go for the female candidate. I'd hazard a guess about the Republicans saying, are they really about transformational candidates? They're Republicans, they're conservative, they want a steady hand. Mm. So, again, the against Obama figures, you know, a new black president, a young black president, is going to be scary for a lot of them. Trump, again, kind of, they're happy, it's a lot of GOP voters are kind of begrudgingly, he's their nominee, but again, against Clinton, because of the media narrative against Clinton of being this person who's not trustworthy, who can't handle power, I think.
Mm. I mean, Mark, what's your sort of take on some of these numbers?
Yeah, I completely agree with that, that there was a vast enthusiasm for the Obama campaign, the likes of which hasn't really been seen for decades, really. I mean, you probably have to go back on the Republican side, maybe Ronald Reagan had similar degrees of enthusiasm, certainly by 1984. For Democrats, you possibly have to go back to FDR for that level of sheer...
JFK.
JFK, maybe. Yeah. Sheer excitement... around a candidate. And it wasn't the Romney, you know, they didn't hate Mitt Romney. Mitt Romney was not a terrible candidate in the eyes of Democrats. He had been a fairly liberal, moderate governor of Massachusetts. Whereas, you know, for Hillary, as you say, America, you know, they used her, she's traditionally a moderate. There's despite the fact, this earth-shattering decision to have a female commander-in-chief for the first time in American history, no one seems to be particularly excited about that. But I find the Democrats, and I'm looking at these numbers, I'm fine with that. I'm fine with the majority of my voters being turned out to be terrified of Trump. And actually, for the Bernie Sanders supporters, it's very important that they're absolutely terrified of Trump.
I'm a little skeptical of the actual methodology of the question, and you might have something to say on this. I mean, clearly, I think from the way the numbers are breaking down that they asked voters to say, are you voting for Trump or against Clinton, sort of giving that binary reaction. And I think a more interesting way to look at the same motivational forces is instead to measure the magnitude of their identification either with one of the candidates or with the party or against the other side in isolation from each other. Because right now there's actually been some research that we're going to focus on in our podcast, The Ballpark, that shows that people who are... Oh, thank you. That people are actually more motivated by the opposition, that they distrust and they hate the opposition more so than they trust and love their own team. Mm. And so I think that you have to look at those two forces and those motivational factors separate from each other in order to compare them rather than just putting them up side by side. Because I would say, of course, like, I'm for Clinton. That's how I would answer that. But I also am very much against Trump. So it's a false dichotomy.
What do we think of Gary Johnson, just moving the conversation on slightly? He's been someone that's been in the news. What is Aleppo? Can't name world leaders. I was listening to his podcast with David Axelrod today, and can't say I was impressed by him. But he's getting 8%, there or thereabouts, of the vote in the polls, at least. I mean, do we think that's going to happen on the day, Chris? Or, I mean, what sort of impact could he have on the race?
I think he's not a nader. I don't think he's going to be a spoiler like Nader was in 2000, for example. I think he's an interesting candidate because he's not really far right. He's libertarian. So he's kind of a salve for the consciences of GOP voters who are kind of worried about Trump but don't want to jump to Clinton. I think as we get closer to the election, his numbers will drop off because people will just stay home. Mm. I don't think they'll turn out and vote for him because he doesn't have a chance. And also the Aleppo stuff is really torpedoed, isn't it? Because the kind of people who would vote for a libertarian would probably be more knowledgeable and more interested in politics and actually be quite disappointed in that. So Johnson's not going to be stealing the sort of the working class voters who don't have a college degree that support Trump.
Mm. Let's move on to Trump. You mentioned Trump. Obviously, it looks like he's...
Donald Trump?
Donald Trump.
Oh, okay, sure. Right.
He's doing not particularly well, shall we say, in the polls. We were talking about that earlier today. He's been sending some tweets. I don't think these were at 3 a.m., but they were still quite... there was quite an animosity in them towards Paul Ryan. For those that haven't seen these, he says, despite winning the second debate in a landslide, brackets every poll, factually not true, but... Mm-hmm. It is hard to do well when Paul Ryan and others give zero support. He also then goes and says, our very weak and ineffective leader, Paul Ryan, had a bad conference call where his members went wild at his disloyalty. Seems like civil war in the Republican Party, Mark.
I mean, it is just fascinating. I'm one of the people who thinks, you know, as I suspect several of us here do, that the presidential race is essentially over. That, you know, Hillary Clinton will be the 45th president of the United States. And I'm fairly confident that nothing will change in the next 3.5 weeks to change that assertion. The question then becomes, what happens with Congress? What happens with particularly the Senate, to some extent the House? I'm not particularly bullish on the House, given the Republican level of gerrymandering. But if you think about the Senate elections, what Republicans need is a couple of things. They need their vote to turn out. And they need moderate voters who are opting for Hillary Clinton in the presidential election to split their ticket down ticket in places like, particularly in places like Pennsylvania, New Hampshire, possibly North Carolina. They need them to split their tickets so that their Republican incumbent senators can get over the top. The problem is, what happens if when reading these tweets criticizing the most prominent Republican in Congress, the Trump supporters, who I think are to some extent distinct, who are less tied into the Republican Party machine and establishment, who may be part of the vast majority of voters who tend not to vote in midterm elections, decide just to skip a line on the Senate elections and the House elections. They'll come in and vote for Trump, and because they don't like Paul Ryan anymore, or they've been instructed not to like Paul Ryan, they'll just vote for Trump and leave. And that, I think, could absolutely destroy Republican Senate chances. And are you happy with me?
We'll come on to this in a moment. But I mean, what does everyone else think about this Paul Ryan dynamic?
I don't know. For me, I don't believe in the idea of a GOP civil war. I believe in the idea of a GOP war with Donald Trump. I don't think there's never been a great deal of coordination between the GOP and Donald Trump. Vince Priebus is just sort of allowing him to do whatever he wants. And so Trump will do what Trump will do, and the GOP will try and do whatever they can to preserve themselves. So, you know, Paul Ryan was on the fence for a long time about endorsing him because he has no choice. I mean, there's nothing that Paul Ryan can do to influence Trump. Actually, there doesn't seem to be that much that Trump can do to influence Paul Ryan anymore. Mm. So I think what will happen if probably Trump loses, he will just spin off and the GOP will kind of try and reconstruct itself. Whether or not it actually will is another question. But I think I don't buy this civil war stuff because I think Trump is such a separate planet in the political solar system in the U.S.
So I disagree with that last point a little bit, but first I want to say that I'm actually shocked that this sort of rift and this conflict hasn't erupted already, basically, because here are two people who are basically the polar ends of the Republican Party, and one person who has this broad appeal to the middle, but perhaps is seen as a compromiser, as someone who even is too willing to negotiate or work with the other side, is tainted just by simply being in the same room as Democrats at points. And then the other side that is speaking to more of the social issues, the nationalistic issues, the racial issues that motivate the far right of the party. But going back to your point about the Civil War, I do think that there is a fundamental Civil War that's represented by these two people, because they're not just popular in a vacuum, or they don't exist in a vacuum. They're very popular with very distinct elements of the party. Paul Ryan is more popular, obviously, with the establishment and with more centrist Republicans and more moderate people in general. And then Donald Trump is clearly more popular with the far right wing. And there's plenty of members of Congress who are far right wing and have been bubbling up for years.
Yeah, but they've had the support of super PACs. They've had the support of the establishment aspect. So I'm talking about the mechanisms of the party.
Sure.
Trump's support comes from having billions of dollars worth of free media coverage.
No, I don't. But it's more than that too, though. I mean, that's discounting the millions and millions of people who have voted for him, and to deny the fact that there is this humongous movement behind him that is completely shocking. I mean, he completely steamrolled the Republican primary in a way that a candidate has not in modern history. So there is a significant movement there. I mean, you can't ignore the voters there, but it's not enough to get, it's not a broad appeal movement. It's not enough to get you over 50+1.
I mean, do we think he could have won? I mean, it seems a few weeks ago that with Hillary's health concerns and that sort of thing, when he was kind of out of the news a lot, his poll numbers were pretty strong. He was around 50-50 in these sort of projections to win the presidency. So do you think he ever had a chance if he'd been managed better?
Or I'm still not where you're at of like, yeah. I think he could still win. Who knows? This
I'm
is the craziest
you.
Year ever.
I mean, Hillary is a truly bad candidate. Her approval ratings will be, I mean, some of them, actually, Hillary's average approval average is edging towards the 50-50 mark again, which is really quite interesting. But she will be, for a new president, I can't think of a president with lower approval ratings winning the presidency for the first time than Hillary Clinton will face. But I think this point about Republican Party split's really interesting, because you've actually, as far as I see it, you've got three factions of relatively equal strength. You've got the party establishment, Rance Priebus, Mitch McConnell.
Mm-hmm.
To some extent, Paul Ryan, that you have to remember that Paul Ryan was, 4-8 years ago, a figure of the hard right. Democrats ran hard against the Ryan budget. There were all kinds of videos.
I read a number of press releases about that.
Exactly. And you had these images of Paul Ryan's going to throw your granny off a cliff by privatizing Social Security. And it just shows you how far the Republican cosmos have shifted. Mm. That Paul Ryan is now a centrist or moderate, which is really quite extraordinary. But the overlooked faction is the conservative movement. People like Glenn Beck, Christian conservatives. So one of the largest Christian magazines in the US didn't endorse Clinton, but just said, do not vote for Trump. Several parts of the more intellectual, traditional evangelical movement that you can trace right back to the culture wars in the 1960s. Almost none of these people have any time for Donald Trump. They're the sort of people behind the Evan McMullen campaign. It's a really, really interesting phenomenon how seeing Donald Trump within a prism of traditional American conservatism, I think, is wrong. Mm. I think much more similar, and I know this is perhaps lazily overplayed, but I'm going to do it, which is that the comparisons to George Wallace, where you start, who was the ran for the Democratic nomination for president in 1964 and 68, then she ran as an independent segregationist governor of Alabama. Mm. He was very popular amongst industrial, white working class, particularly men in states like Wisconsin, states like Maryland. He did very well in the primaries. And I think comparisons with that are more valid. He doesn't sit within the Republican Party, but should he want to, particularly if we're thinking about the 2018 primaries for the midterm elections, he could prove that Trump movement could prove very, very effective in taking some seats in Congress.
Do you think that he is going to disrupt or break the Reagan coalition that is fundamentally built on the conservative right, the religious right, and all of those different groups that were brought together really in the 80s? Through Reagan's concerted efforts to piece them together? I mean, has he broken them apart?
I would find that the party law, one thing that strikes me, not just in the US, but in the UK as well and elsewhere, is that party loyalties do seem to be pretty strong. There are people out there that will just vote for the right coloured rosette in this country or the right sort of the candidate with the, you know, the elephant or the donkey in the US.
In North Carolina, they call it yellow dog Democrats.
Exactly, and it just seems like there are people, and this is one of the dynamics that I'm curious about, get some of your opinions on. With Donald Trump, it feels like that when his poll numbers move up and down, it's often not that it's independents going away from him so much. It's often that the Republican Party's voters itself either deciding they can't stomach him or they actually can after all. And that seems to be the dynamic. I mean, what do you guys think Trump should focus on in the next sort of few weeks? Because, I mean, he is arguably the most unconventional candidate I can remember. But you both seem to suggest, Chris and Denise, that you feel like he can still win. So how does he do that if he can?
Well, people keep talking about how whoever is in the headlines is losing, basically. And Donald Trump has been in the headlines solidly for the last 2 weeks, 3 weeks even. And when the last time Hillary Clinton was really front and center was when she had a real dip after the convention, and it was before the debates where she got another kind of boomerang back up. So all he can do really is attempt to put her front and center, you know, is just rail against her. And he's attempting to do that in very unsavory ways right now, which I think are very dangerous, honestly, for democratic discussion. But he's grasping at anything he has, I think.
If I was Trump, I would go quiet and get my surrogates to attack Clinton. Mm-hmm. But I wouldn't get it to attack Clinton over the Bill Clinton stuff because it's too old. I think that's not going to work. I'd get rid of the, you know, don't do the Miss America stuff. Don't make it about you. Make it about her. And make it about Benghazi. Make it about the emails. Make it about that Clinton isn't trustworthy. Now, I don't think those things are true about Clinton, but a lot of Trump supporters do, and a lot of people in the GOP.
A lot of Americans do. Let's
a lot of Americans do. And so I try and put the spotlight on her. I mean, there was a question in the first debate where he asked her about the 30,000 emails that wasn't released, and she completely dodged the question. So there are things there that I think she is vulnerable on. So if I was Trump, I would shut up and just try and let Hillary do some damage to herself.
Before we get everyone's closing remarks, Mark, you've been looking at some of the sort of early voting and the Senate projections, haven't you? I mean, is there anything you kind of want to... that's caught your eye there?
Yeah, I'll deal with the sort of overall Senate projection first. And what's really interesting is whilst the Trump campaign heads into what I view as a death spiral, the Republicans in the Senate actually holding up, their numbers holding up pretty well. Pat Toomey in Pennsylvania, some polls out this week showing him with a larger lead than he did a couple of weeks ago. Kelly Ayotte in New Hampshire, her numbers not looking too terrible. The Republican challenger in Nevada, who's trying to win the seat where Harry Reid is standing down, not looking too bad. So Republicans in the Senate, they must have thought a couple of weeks ago, hey, we'll probably lose the presidency, but our chances of keeping the Senate and holding up Hillary's nominations, let alone any legislation, looking pretty good. Now, my huge worry, if I'm the Republicans, particularly connected around the tapes, is how many traditional parts of the Republican coalition, as you were saying, will now sit on their hands. We'll now go, look, this is the straw that broke the camel's back. I actually think that the Republican Senate polling numbers are grossly inflated by people who aren't actually going to show up at all, because they're not going to show up to vote for Donald Trump. Why would they vote just in a Senate election on the same day when the entire media narrative is dominated by? And just looking at these maps now of North Carolina, early voting, North Carolina is quite interesting, very polarized state, very, very close in both the 2008-2012 elections. It's often changed hands in terms of its senator and in terms of the governor's race. What's quite extremely interesting is the postal voting figures that are already going on. Usually, postal voting in North Carolina is dominated by Republicans.
Yeah.
Democratic early voting tends to happen in person at polling stations, whereas older, particularly suburban Republicans, traditionally they choose to do their early voting by mail. But if you look at these maps, you see that in the largest counties in the state, Wake County, where Raleigh is, Mecklenburg County, where Charlotte is, the number of Democrats casting postal votes is hugely increasing, whereas the number of Republicans casting postal votes falling. That means one of two things. Well, three things, really. Firstly, the Democratic ground game in North Carolina is excellent, and Hillary has far more field offices there to get these people organized than the Trump campaign or the Republican Party do. Secondly, are Republican voters just waiting to see whether they can, at the last minute, stomach voting for Donald Trump, seeing what developments there will be in the last few weeks of the campaign? Or, in my view, more likely, the polls are wrong. This is not as close an election in North Carolina as it looks like. And actually, Republican voters, traditional parts of the Republican coalition, are just leaving their postal ballot to one side, sitting on their hands, and don't intend to turn up this year, whilst telling pollsters, and we've seen this in British elections many times, telling pollsters, oh, of course, we'll show up.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I want to close today. We're getting everyone's sort of closing thoughts. Maybe let's play a bit of a game, and I'll get each of you to sort of put what percentage you would put chances are there are on a Clinton presidency, and maybe why you think that. I'll give you a couple of moments to think about that while I explain, because I mean the 538 forecast, as we saw earlier, has about an 83 to 85-ish% chance of a Clinton presidency. I mean, I feel like it's actually a little bit higher than that. I mean, I get that the Trump vote, Republican vote, could unite behind Trump in the closing moments, but I think for him to surge back in the polls again, he has to get out of the way, as we've talked about earlier, but also has to sort of not mess something up again in the next sort of 3.5 weeks. And I just feel like if there was just one more tape that comes out, maybe about women again, maybe about something else, it's just going to knock him on the floor. I just don't. And he seems to be going rogue as well with the Republican Party. And that organisation, which Mark sort of refers to, and that funding, is going to be telling on the day. So I just feel like, having had a wobble in September where it did feel like Trump was winning, and I think he probably was, and when the focus was on Hillary, it feels like there's not enough time now for him to come back. And that's why I personally would say it's a very strong likelihood of Clinton winning. But I'll start with you, Chris, and we'll sort of go round the table. I mean, what sort of percentage chance would you give to Hillary, and why do you think that?
I'm going to regret this after the election, but I would say about 70%. And it's interesting, you talked about wobbles already. And actually, if you look at after the conventions, the polls really tightened up. And I think even though there's only 3.5 weeks to go, I think there is possibility of more of a tightening. There could be more email stuff out there for Clinton. Probably not, but you just don't know. Mm. I mean, if Trump, by some miracle, does shut up and not do anything, you could see a tightening. Maybe GOP voters go, actually, we don't want a Democrat in the House for another 4 years. Or even Democrats themselves go, actually, I'm not sure if we trust her. So 70%.
Denise, what do you think?
I'm going to take the tact of what motivates people to take this election seriously and turn out. I'd say she has a 51% chance of winning. and that's also because I'm highly superstitious on races that make me very nervous. But I'm also going to punt a little bit by putting a little bit more confidence in that. I think that a number of the predictions right now about the Democrats winning back the Senate are very conservative. And I think that they have a much better chance of winning back, because they ultimately really need 4 seats to win back enough of to get to 50. And then they have the tie break if Hillary Clinton wins and Tim Kaine is then the president of the Senate. So they just need 4 seats. And with Wisconsin and Indiana and New Hampshire, I think Kelly Ayotte is in more trouble than... And Illinois with... Mark Kirk is likely on his way out. I think that they have a clear path to winning 4, and there are a couple other places where they can do 5. The place that really makes that iffy in my mind is Nevada right now, because that is not looking great for Democrats, and that's Harry Reid's seat. And so if they lose that, then that makes their chances... That to me, is what hurts their chances, but still, I'm going to put them at, like, 65%. To win back the Senate.
We'll come back to Denise in a moment and get you guys to talk about your podcast. But before we do, Mark, what sort of percentage chance would you give
Hillary? Oh, if the election was today, 100%. If the election is where it is, 95%.
It probably is going to be where it is, right?
But I think the Senate point is absolutely critical. The main point of winning the presidency currently in the America of 2016 is the ability to nominate Supreme Court justices.
Yes.
And you obviously have a vacancy on the Supreme Court. Yes. Of a conservative seat. And if a liberal, maybe Merrick Garland, maybe someone younger and more liberal who Hillary decides to nominate, if a liberal is nominated to the Supreme Court, that will change the balance of the Supreme Court. So you'll have a 5-4 liberal-conservative majority for the first time since 1971.
Mm-hmm.
And that will change everything in terms of campaign finance, in terms of Second Amendment rights, all these kinds of issues. Progressives will be able to make a lot of change on these issues for the Liberal Supreme Court, particularly in a political structure where it's almost impossible to get legislation through because you're very unlikely to control all branches. So I think I'm with you on I'm bullish on the Senate projections, but also do worry, given how unpopular Hillary is, whether voters might just split their ticket down the ballot in order to not give Hillary a blank check.
Right, and almost just as a sort of protest vote that satisfies their frustration with the top of the ticket choices, basically.
It does feel like, actually, you've just given Donald Trump his campaign strategy for the last 3.5 weeks, which is the Supreme Court, right?
I mean, there we go. I disagree. I think Donald wants to take this whole thing down with him. I think Donald would be furious if he lost and Republicans held the Senate.
Yeah.
So, final word to Denise.
Yes.
I have it on good authority that people that listen to the show and watch the show like podcasts about American politics. So I think they're
lucky
in luck.
Us.
So tell us about the ballpark.
Sure. So the ballpark is the podcast from the U.S. Center at the London School of Economics. Chris is a co-host along with myself and another woman named Sophie Donzelman. And the three of us get together to chat about academic research on America, on any parts of the states. And we really try to dive in deep to a certain topic and to a certain approach to understand what's going on behind the headlines, what's going on in a sort of more nuanced and academically rigorous understanding of the things.
How can they find it?
Just Google the Ballpark Podcast. It comes up.
iTunes.
iTunes, SoundCloud.
Android, all that.
Yep.
Well, I'm a late arriver to the podcast, but I think it's great. So I recommend all
jump on the bandwagon.
Jump on the bandwagon, certainly. Well, that's unfortunately all we've got time for this week. But a big thanks to my guests, Mark Gettleson, Chris Gilson, and Denise Barron for joining me today. Great discussion. But let's stay tuned for more episodes in the coming weeks where we see whether a Hillary Clinton presidency really is as inevitable as it sounds.